Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is December 22nd, 2020, and my guest is author Gary Shiffman of Georgetown University. He is CEO of two firms, Giant Oak and Consilient. Those firms use machine learning to help people deal with risk. Our topic for today is his new book, The Economics of Violence, How Behavioral Science Can Transform Our View of Crime, Insurgency, and Terrorism. I want to let parents know there may be some adult or disturbing themes in today's episode. I want to encourage listeners to go to econtalk.org for our annual survey of your favorite episodes. Gary, welcome to Econ Talk.
Russ, it's really great to be with you. Thanks very much.
First, tell us a little about your career and how you came to write this book.
Yeah, it's an unusual background for an economist, perhaps. I started my career in the U.S. military, in the Navy. My first job out of college, I like to say, was the Gulf War, if you remember that a long time ago. And so just traveled around the world, saw conflict, saw coercion, saw violence, came back to the United States after being overseas for my first 4 years out of college. I worked in the Pentagon. I worked in the United States Senate as a national security advisor to the Republican leadership in the Senate. I worked on issues such as terrorism and peace talks and topics like that. And at that point, I started my PhD work at George Mason University in economics. And so I came into economics with a mission, and the mission was to make sense of the world. I had started my academic career in my master's degree at Georgetown, where I now teach. And I learned a lot of political science and IR theory and
international
relations. And I was incredibly disappointed. I was young and eager to change the world, and I was so excited to be at an elite institution, and IR theory just didn't answer any questions for me. It didn't click. It didn't make sense. It wasn't the world that I had just come, spent 8 years traveling around and seeing. It didn't work. And coincidentally, I met for coffee with a young economist named Tyler Cowen, and told him that, Adam Smith made sense to me and Hans Morgenthau did not. And Tyler said, welcome to our community. So I pursued the PhD in economics with the idea of understanding conflict and violence and coercion in the world. And so my career since then has been the combination of economics and real world application in the national security space. So how do we make us safer and more secure, or maybe better stated, how do we make the world more difficult for people who want to do bad things? And really a focus on changing the world and doing things with real operational impact in the world, but really leveraging and leaning on the academic disciplines that are available to us as practitioners. And for me, my bias is in economics, but I'm open to any sort of science that helps us make sense of the world. And my default and go-to is economics. Sometimes I describe myself as a behavioral scientist, sometimes as an economist, but it's this idea of understanding these complex problems. And the reason I like economics is because it is a science of human decision making. And if you think about national security, it is fundamentally a human problem, right? We don't have wars but for people, at least up till 2020. So it's really about understanding human behavior to have an impact in the world.
Yeah, I think the key question is you know, what is the role of rationality, and how do we think about rationality? Because that word is a bit of a suitcase word, a word that you can stuff a lot of things into. Your book has three case studies. We may get to them in more detail, but you look at Pablo Escobar, Joseph Kony, and Osama bin Laden, who on the surface are a criminal, a drug dealer, a criminal, an insurgent, and a terrorist. And yet you make the point, I think, throughout the book that they kind of, all three of them are all three at the same time, and that maybe the standard ways we label people and the ways that we describe their motivation by their some purported motivator, religion, money, et cetera, may be missing the fuller picture. So our goal today is I'm going to let you try to convince us that that's a better way to look at it than the standard way. And occasionally I'm going to agree with you that there may be times I disagree. I want to start with a quote. You write, quote, you say that you have, quote, grown skeptical of many popular theories of non-state organized violence. Non-state organized violence. For example, again, quoting you, I question policies based on slogans such as radical Islam and other national or religious identities. Instead, I've come to appreciate science-based approaches to national security, particularly those based on social science and economics. So what's wrong with thinking about, say, terrorism as a religious issue? Sometimes it's a political issue. It's not motivated just by religion. It can be motivated by ideology, obviously. But that's the standard way people talk about it in the press and in the halls of Congress. Why is that? What's wrong with that?
Russ, thanks for leading with that question. I think that the language matters, and I think that our propensity to label groups of people by some identity marker is lazy and inaccurate. So I'm going to, you know, state that very strongly. And as an economist, you know, we might say that I might restate that to say we're confusing correlation with causation. So, you know, the world, you know, 25% of the world is Muslim, and there are not that many Islamic terrorists. So the fact that we attribute Islam with terrorism is just plain inaccurate. I mean, it's grossly oversimplification. And we tend to do that because it allows us to make categorizations that are easy to understand and digestible, but not necessarily correct. And I think that's the main goal of this book, is to really address this question, is do these identity labels help us to understand the phenomena that we care about in the world, such as terrorism, insurgency, and drug trafficking, or do they mislead us? And I'm arguing in this book that they're mostly misleading, and that there is a better way, and the better way is to think about markets, to think about humans and institutions and markets and firms and prices and entrepreneurs. And if we pivot from that's a drug dealer, that's an insurgent, that's a Muslim, that's a Mexican, if we get rid of those terms and we say that's a firm, that's an entrepreneur, we can simplify the story, we can make sense of it, and I think it's more accurate.
Okay, we're going to get to that. I want to take one more step back, though, and I love this. One of my favorite parts of the book, not directly related to violence, but you talk about Robinson Crusoe, who's alone on an island. You say, what happens to Crusoe if another person, whom we will call Friday, appears on the island? We know that humans seek to barter and trade with other humans to better their situation. If we placed a wild boar on the island, Crusoe would likely hunt the boar and roast it for dinner. But it would be absurd to posit that Crusoe would hunt Friday and roast him for dinner. Why is that? And I think that's, you know, I've never heard that example. It's a beautiful, I have a different version of that, not as dramatic. But it's a fantastic point. that the arrival of Friday doesn't make Crusoe poorer, for starters, right, and that eating him would be a mistake, a tactical error. Why?
And the fact that he just intuitively knows that to be the case. This is this idea, and I you know, know you're an Adam Smith aficionado as well, but you know, we have this fundamental human nature, which is described or maybe summarized by the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another. So no matter where I am in the world today, as I travel around literally or just, you know, reading the paper in the morning, or if I look back through any point in history, if I can go back to this idea that every character that I'm seeing in this plot that I'm witnessing has the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange, then that's a scientific principle from which I can launch into my analysis and say, well, why are people killing each other? Why is this person, you know, coercing these other people? And just go back to this fundamental idea that there's a propensity to truck, barter, and exchange. And I like the Robinson Crusoe story because it's a very simple way of making the point that as a reader and you read that passage that you just read out loud, you know it's true. You know that Robinson Crusoe didn't think, hey, there's like 2 days worth of food. Robinson Crusoe knew that this is an opportunity to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another.
Or cooperate. It doesn't have to be, obviously, in this case, it doesn't have to be literal truck, barter, and exchange. If there were 20 people, it would be maybe. But
right. Right. Well, with two people, as you said, there's this assumption that they could be better off. So there's absolutely just the benefit of two people creating more wealth than just one person through specialization and division of labor, right? But then take that to the furthest extreme, which economists like to, you know, put up goalposts and go to the furthest extreme is an individual walks into a crowded market in Jerusalem with a backpack full of explosives and detonates it and kills himself and, you know, 100 innocent people around him. So you've got this fundamental human nature and the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange and be better off. And you've got suicide terrorism. It's like, how do we reconcile all of this if these are extremes of human behavior? And I think economics gives us the tools to think about and address those questions. I don't think that anything is easy, but I think that's a much better approach to understanding violence than is saying, well, that was a Muslim that blew himself up and we know things about Muslims. That's just, you know, that's just not the right way to address things.
But the standard, I would say the standard way that economists often think about this problem, first, of course, there is an economics approach to religion. Larry Anacone, who I know you know, yes, you reference him in the book, who's been a guest on the program, talks about that. We may get to that. But the more narrow way to think about economics in that setting is, okay, you got a group of people who are truck bartering and changing, shopping in the market peacefully, respecting each other's property rights, enforced by a set of police and government, and also norms of how to interact. Then you have a terrorist, a murderer who disrupts that and kills a bunch of people. A lot of people would say, well, you know, that person who the economist approach to the terrorist could be, oh, well, that person didn't have many prospects in life. They didn't have much to live for. They had a better labor market where they were, if they had a bit more opportunity, if Israel could trade, which they are now starting to do more of with their neighbors, there's a better chance that those kind of things won't happen. And I think that's true. I think that's a good way to think about it. But I don't know what it – right? You can go to one extreme and say the terrorist is just an economics standard of living problem. Just got to give them better choices. Or you could say, oh, they've got this destructive ideology that they believe in and that harms us. Why – it seems to me it's both. So why do you want to focus on one over the other?
I don't see it as one over the other. I think that as economists, we can acknowledge that religion provides institutional rules and constraints on human behavior. So being Jewish, being Muslim, being Christian, being whatever, is going to constrain behavior. And it's okay to acknowledge that. I think where we go wrong is when we oversimplify the world to say all Jews are this, all Muslims are this, all Christians are this, all Mexicans are this, all Colombians are this, all Americans are this. And I think we do that. I think we unintentionally go too far with these identity labels. And I think it's appropriate that we pull back and say, well, maybe we've gone too far with identity labels, and think about the role of religion. So it's not, as I say in the book, it's not Islam as Islam that matters. It's Islam as an institution which shapes human behavior that does matter. And if we think about it that way, we can bring religion back into this discussion. And I love Larry Iannacone's work and love to incorporate his ideas into this. So I'm not saying religion doesn't matter. I'm saying it doesn't matter in the way people think it matters.
The part that I love that you emphasize is the kinship part. And, yes. And the argument that a lot of what we're calling terrorists or insurgents or criminals are providing something else that is masked by the things that are costly to us as the non-participants, the terror, the death, the activities, and that the opportunity to affiliate with these groups gives participants a way to truck barter and exchange more effectively because they can trust their insiders. There's a role for loyalty there. So that I thought was the most provocative idea in the book. Why don't you expand on that?
Sure. I think we have this tendency to divide the world into us versus them, and we do this regularly, whether we're aware of it or not. And so this idea of kinship is actually somewhat pervasive in economic literature. There's Hirschleifer addresses it. There's kinships and fictive kinships and
explain what you mean by that, because that's important. What is So kinship is you're my cousin, but what's right. A fictive kinship? What do you mean by that?
A fictive kinship is it's not an actual blood kinship or a blood relationship, but we have the psychological construct of some sort of a familial tie. So we see this in the crime world. We see this in mafias, for example. So if you study the literature on mafias, or if you just watch a good Godfather, the Godfather, or another movie, or read a novel, the language is all about family. There's a crime family. There are the five families of the five crime families of New York. So it's all family. It's all brother. It's your loyalty to your brother in the crime family actually supersedes your loyalty to your blood brother. So this is the Cosa Nostra story. So we're somewhat, as humans, we're really susceptible to this idea of fictive kinships, and we do it all of the time. There's literature about the military creates these fictive kinship. So when you go to war and you go to battle, and again, I started my career in the military in a war, you develop very, very strong bonds with these folks you go into battle with that really rival any other blood relationships that you have. So I think everybody can think about these kind of kinships. It can be as simple as this weekend, I'm rooting for the Washington football team, Russ, and you might be rooting for, the Baltimore Ravens.
Go ahead. Never.
Sorry, I didn't mean to offend.
Yeah.
but we develop kinships around things like sports teams that we root for. So these, I think, are really important traits, human traits that are probably correlated with survival, the long-term survival of our species. But they're present today. And so we do this, we can assume others do this, and it allows us to build trust. Trust allows us to engage in trade, right? It's hard to imagine trade in the absence of trust. I think markets require trust. Trust comes about through lots of different ways, rules and enforcement and contract law and courts is one way, but kinship or fictive kinship is another way in which we build trust. And if you're in the illicit economy, Russ, if you and I were drug dealers and I wanted you to manage my books, if you stole from me, I couldn't sue you. I can't bring you to court because we're drug dealers. So how do I overcome trust, the trust hurdle? Well, if you were a cousin of mine, I might actually let you manage my books because you're less likely to defect on me. And if you're not my real cousin, I am going to get to know you and your family and have you over to my house to meet my family. And I'm going to create a fictive kinship with you because that's a way to build trust and to deter defection.
And if I betray that trust, you're going to kill me and maybe my family members.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Sorry. It was a nice dinner. I enjoyed it. I'm going to step back now and try to, and this is the way that I see your story, and I'll let you correct me or add to it. We have certain illegal activities that there's still a big demand for, drugs being the most obvious example. People who provide those take risks, but they can make a lot of money. To create the networks that a firm would have to have in a legal economy is going to require substitutes for the ways that people would normally interact. The threat of violence, as you just mentioned, would be one of those ways. And so these organizations that are violent, doing illegal things, and sometimes offering an ideology or a salvation theme alongside all that, it's all the same package. It's just a way that an entrepreneur at the top of this organization can have great success. And you paint both Pablo Escobar and Osama bin Laden as entrepreneurs, and Joseph Kony as entrepreneurs who aimed high. The only problem I have with the story is that they both died terrible deaths and fairly young. Not totally young, but so the challenge I think of making this a so-called rational enterprise is it usually ends in a hail of gunfire. So you could argue that it's worth it along the way. They get enough benefits, but these are people who have chosen a very dark niche to express themselves. Your point, I think, which is profound, is that. But they are expressing themselves. That is really, it's a form of self-actualization. It might be one that you and I would find unappealing, but for them, it was just, it's the same. It's not much different than, I won't name anybody to compare them to Osama bin Laden or Pablo Escobar, but think of your favorite CEO of a legitimate firm who's been successful. These people become rich. They become famous. And they have a lot of love from their adherents. Is that a good summary of what you're selling here?
Yeah, absolutely. That's to the extent that I'm selling a story, I guess. Yes,
of course you are.
That's a summary. that's a summary. It's a very good summary. The myth of Pablo Escobar is that when he
tell
was
us a little bit about him, because many people may not have heard of him, know who he is. So give a little background.
So Pablo Escobar was the head of the Medellin cartel, and he is largely considered the first narco-terrorist. So the word narco-terrorist, was really first used in the popular vernacular describing Pablo Escobar, Colombian. And there's this story about Pablo Escobar getting his photo taken in front of the White House here on Pennsylvania Avenue, saying that he's going to negotiate with the president of the United States one day. So he, I don't know his heart. I don't know what he really wanted, but at least that's part of the mythology of Pablo, which he had very grand political ambitions. He started out as a street level thug. He, stole cars and sold, sold the goods of his proceeds. And then he figured out that he could make more money by by protecting other people's cars. So the classic protection racket, which is you start out doing something, some criminal activity, and then you realize you can make more money by protecting people from yourself, from that very same criminal activity. So this is Pablo. This is Pablo Escobar. So he runs a protection racket, and then he kind of stumbles into smuggling things across borders, which is another form of protection. Plata or plomo, which is lead or silver. Basically, if you are a Colombian police officer or an enforcement official of some sort and you run into Pablo, you have a choice. He's going to give you silver, and if you don't, he's going to give you money, and if you don't take it, he's going to shoot you. He became popular for silver or lead when you see him, and then he just happened to be kind of at the right place at the right time, which is the United States discovers its love for cocaine, and cocaine production moves into Colombia. And so this is a guy who's got well-established smuggling routes. He's got massive numbers of police, military, law enforcement, and judges in Colombia on his payroll anyways. And now he can make orders of magnitude more money by smuggling and by paying off government officials, because he's now smuggling cocaine into Miami. And that's where he really becomes wealthy and famous. Inside of, and I think it's important, in Medellin, which is his hometown, he actually does become, he's the FBI's most wanted criminal, and he walks in broad daylight through the streets of Medellin. He's not in hiding, because the whole town of Medellin loves and supports him. He builds roads, schools, hospitals. He provides that social safety net that the government is unable to do, because he's actually got more money than the government. So this is Pablo Escobar. So yes, he dies with a bullet to the head by law enforcement agents eventually.
It took a long time.
But it took a long time. And look at today, we're still talking about him. I mean, I don't know, Russ, if he didn't win the game in a sense, right? Did he really not get what he wanted?
Well, my favorite part of your book, one of my favorite parts, is where he's in prison, living like a king. Not much different from some of the stories that David Skarbek tells. You referenced David's work, who was on the program, of how drug dealers in American prisons extend their reach back into their home neighborhoods through Confederates, friends, loyal lieutenants, and so on, demand things of people when they're released from prison, which are enforced through the threat of violence, which is really an important part of this. I want to hear, though, why he builds these schools and of course, terrorist organizations. Again, I think one of the things that's useful about your framework is that it should be blurred, the line between terrorists, social providers, and social service providers, because they often do all these. They also all sell illicit things. They raise money through illicit things, illegal things. They provide services to nearby citizens, and they also carry on some ideological political goals. So it's kind of another way to think about it, sort of a shadow government in a certain dimension in these places where formal governments are weak. But what's the gain to an Escobar of those schools? Now, he gets the adulation of the people around him, but I guess he also gets the protection. Is that part of the motive there?
Yeah, sure. So
the loyalty.
Again, just think about Escobar and Osama bin Laden is entrepreneurs. They need a safe haven from which to operate. And so they provide social services and social benefits, which increases loyalty and deters defection. It's that simple. Ellie Berman, whose work I'm sure you know, he writes about this, where he looked at the terrorist groups in committing acts of terrorism in Israel, and the groups, Hamas, at the top of the list, engages in more deadly acts of violence, and they also provide more social services. And so the point he makes is that it's by providing social services, you create the club, So you have a club goods model is what Ellie does with it. And so you encourage loyalty, you deter defection, and your ability to engage in high value illicit activities is a function of your ability to deter defection. If you cannot deter defection, you cannot engage in high value criminal activity. And so Pablo Escobar gets a safe haven. He gets the entire city to operate from by providing public services and public goods to all of the people. So it might feed his ego. Again, I don't know his heart and soul, but it might make him feel good to walk down the streets and be hailed as a hero. But it also allows him the freedom to operate a global criminal enterprise without, you know, with a nice quality of life in which he's not really hiding or on the run. And it's actually seems like a pretty rational and smart thing to do.
So violence plays an unusual role in these stories that I think goes beyond, it's a special kind of incentive effect that I think maybe is underappreciated. I always talk about how, you know, survey results in places where violence is casual and normal are uninformative, those survey results, because people are afraid to tell the truth.
Right.
You tell the story, horrifying story where Escobar, tied up a servant of his, threw him into a swimming pool and watched him drown in front of his guests so he could announce this is what happens to those who steal from Pablo Escobar. I'm reminded of the group, I can't remember now who it was, when the British were in India, somebody, I can't remember who it was now, they found three men sleeping. They would behead two of them and leave the third one to wake up to spread the word, because that person is more effective than three dead people. A person who's survived that then tells folks. And it reminded me, strangely, because I'm strange, but it reminded me of Solzhenitsyn and Vasily Grossman, who write about how a person in a situation of violence and corruption and degradation who chooses to stay undegraded, refuses to advance their own self-interest because of what they understand it will do to their sense of self. And they both men honor the people who in the gulag refuse to advance themselves at the expense of others. And economics says you should. Economics often, I think bad economics, but economics will say, well, the rational thing is to be violent. The rational thing is to raise the cost. The rational thing is to in a zero-sum game, make sure you get ahead, not behind. And I think there's a question of principles, morals, self, I don't know what you want to call it. Economics doesn't have much to say about it, but it seems to me once violence is on the table, the normal ways that we think about our self-interest and incentives get ratcheted up so high that they kind of overwhelm everything else. You know, it's like saying to someone, oh, you know, don't worry about betraying Pablo Escobar. We'll pay you enough money to make it worth your while. Well, there probably isn't enough money for most people because they'll do some things to you that aren't worth any amount of money that you could imagine. Maybe.
Yeah. So I think two ideas in what you just said that I want to respond to. The first is, I think the iron rule of autocracy is very simple. It's this message: if you challenge me, you will lose and I will win.
Yeah.
I think that's like that's just it. That's the rule.
That's
so
the goal.
You apply that anywhere in history, anywhere in the world, at any time in history, anywhere in the world, and the successful autocrat. And the autocrat can be the leader of a drug gang in your neighborhood, or it could be, you know, the leader of a political party, you know, in a democratic country. But if you're the leader, what you want to convey is, if you challenge me, you will lose and I will win. So how do you go about doing that? Well, if you're Pablo Escobar, if you're any sort of criminal, you need to back to the idea of if you're running the books for our drug gang, I'm going to have you and your family over for dinner, but I need to let you know that if you challenge me, you're going to lose and I'm going to win. And I think that's a universal rule. Like, and you read any novel of fiction, any real life story, and you're going to see a variation on that theme play out. So So that's my first response. The second is that I think when economists talk about value, we have to define the word more broadly than something that can be reduced to a dollar value, a monetary value. So in the story that you tell, and I'm not familiar with that literature, I've heard you talk about it a couple times now, though, is self-esteem. Like I have, for whatever reason, and this could be the introduction of culture, religion, other things, but I've got some sort of moral code that I live by, and I find value in not deviating from that code. That's a very rational thing. Economists should be able to account for that pretty simply.
Yeah, they struggle with it, though. I think sometimes yes. It's hard to measure and hard to put in the equations is part of it. We mentioned fiction earlier. The Wire is one of my favorite shows, and at least I saw the first couple seasons, two or three, yes. I can't remember now, but the first season opens is about the drug war and the Baltimore police at war with the drug dealers on the streets of Baltimore. And the reason I think it's a powerful film, powerful series, and I think, David Simon, who created it, has some deep insights, is that there's kind of a dance between both sides that we are often ignored our peril, which is that the police do want to catch the drug dealers, but they also profit from the drug dealers being out there as a source of reason for them to exist, have big budgets, and so on. And I wonder how much people really want to catch Pablo Escobar, especially in Colombia. First of all, he killed tons of judges and people who would normally be against him. Nominally, governments are supposed to stop drug dealers. It's not really my I wonder whether they should. It doesn't seem to make much difference. All it does is spend a lot of money chasing them around, and it doesn't seem to have a big impact on the amount of drugs. Maybe it reduces it to what it would otherwise be. It's possible. But the costs are very, very high. But when I think about a less organized government situation, say in a poorer country than the United States, how badly do those folks really want to? Is Pablo Escobar an enemy for them? I'm not sure he's an enemy in the United States either. But we have these narratives, also a different form of fiction. We have these narratives about that these people are our enemy. Pablo Escobar is providing a service. It's a destructive service, cocaine, but is in a certain way. But it's what people wanted, and his government maybe pretended to try to stop him. I don't know. It could be part of the. And when they tried to stop him, he killed him. So the combination of ineffective governance there, creates a very strange dynamic between the two sides, it seems to me.
So we have an agency problem in the sense that some politicians have different goals than some police officers might have. And so we have to disaggregate the decision-making process and the preferences and the optimization functions of the different individuals and players involved. But in general, what you see, if you look across crime, insurgency, terrorism, across countries and cultures and religions around the world and throughout history, you see that there tends to be a threshold below which politicians don't care and above which the politicians get involved. So when Pablo Escobar was smuggling drugs into the United States, he wasn't really a priority inside of Colombia until a prosecutor decides that he thinks it's starting to have a corrupting influence. And so then Pablo kills the prosecutor, and then Pablo starts to kill other politicians, and bombs start blowing up in town. And so now it becomes a political priority to actually go after Pablo. But before that, when he was just selling drugs into the United States, they kind of left him alone. And back to the point you raised earlier, where eventually they built a prison for the Medellin cartel. And they said, you all move into the prison and stop blowing things up. And then we're going to leave you alone. And so they actually ran the Medellin cartel from inside of the prison. The barbed wire faced out, meaning they had a safe haven in which they didn't want anybody to come in. the politicians got what they wanted, which is a decrease in violence. They didn't care about the drugs leaving Colombia going to the United States. They just didn't want Colombian innocent people getting killed. That's a common theme. The Cosa Nostra, the Sicilian mafia in Sicily, operated for 150 years just fine. They did great. And then there were mafia wars in which prosecutors and judges started to get killed. And then public opinion turned against them. So it didn't matter at that point how many hospitals, roads, and bridges you built as a drug dealer. Once you're killing judges and politicians, public opinion could turn against you. So politicians, there tends to be a threshold at which violence is a nuisance versus violence is a national priority. Mexican elections have gone back and forth over the last 20 years based upon, if we crack down on the drug dealers, that's good, but violence increases. If we don't crack down on the drug dealers, they make more money, but violence drops. Right. And
they face the external pressure from the United States, say, to do something about it. And that incentive also plays.
Right.
As
which
a
is
role.
today's news and headlines is that in The Wire. And I love The Wire. I'm on the bandwagon of best TV show ever. I'm in that group.
Top five for me.
Yeah. What I love about it is it does exactly what I'm trying to do in my book, which is it blurs the lines. The drug dealers are bad guys and the cops are good guys. Well, it doesn't come out that way in The Wire. It turns out that life is more complicated and humans are more complicated. And if we take the firms, entrepreneurs, and markets discussion into The Wire, it actually makes sense. So let's not label people as cops are good, drug dealers are bad. Let's look at firms, institutions, markets, and incentives. And now you can really understand why people are behaving the way they're behaving. And that's a much more clear and enlightening way to look at the world, I believe.
So I agree with that up to a point. Obviously, I agree with it because I think incentives matter. And I think markets produce outcomes that no individual intends and that are just the reality that we need to think about. You can't just change that. You can't, the idea that you could make something illegal and therefore solve it is a really important. Actually, that's so obviously true to an economist and so obviously not true to most people that maybe we should spend a little bit of time on it, because I think most people think, well, if something's bad, we just make it against the law without thinking about subsidize something that we think is good, as if that solves, a problem. It often leads to a set of more complicated things. But, when we think about The Wire, I think your approach of thinking, the drug dealers they're running a business. We don't like to think of it maybe that way. You and I do, but most people don't. That's kind of weird. What do you mean they're running a business? They have employees. They have labor issues. They have price issues. They have competition. Right. And of course, all of that, because the courts cannot be used, they have to find alternative ways to deal with defection, disloyalty, unpleasant outcomes that which didn't happen. And so as a result, you get violence as a way to deal with that. You didn't mention, but your book does. At one point, Pablo Escobar takes down an airliner, a quote, terrorist act. And so he's a drug dealer. He's got political ambition, which we didn't talk about. So, what is he? Is he an insurgent, a terrorist, or drug dealer? He's all three. And it's your point is, which is, I think, profound, is that it's not obvious that it's useful to describe him as, say, a criminal. He is a criminal. But if we think of him as only a criminal, we don't hit the full story. The challenge I have for you is that when we think about ways to reduce these things, if that's an ideal, it's not obvious how to leverage this richer understanding. So I agree with you, certainly as an economist, that understanding the incentives, institutions, norms, values that folks have, choices that people face, helps us understand more accurately what's going on. But you also make the claim that it helps us fight it if we want to fight it. And I wasn't convinced by that. So I want to let you make the case now. You argue that this identity category idea of, you argue that this is unproductive, Why is it more productive? I agree it's more accurate to realize that there are all kinds of issues involved, ego, alternatives, ambition, and that often these outcomes are a result of those more interesting forces than just, say, an ideological predilection. How does it help us, you know, do something about it if we want to?
Wow. So you can't take action and expect a desired outcome if you don't understand what's causing the situation to begin with. So it seems kind of obvious to me that we have to understand, or at least attempt to understand, causation if we want to try to bring about a different outcome. And I think the tools of economics really help us to do that. There's a large body of literature on radicalization and counter-radicalization, and some of my friends are involved in that. There are large departments of the U.S. government working on it. And I'm not sure it's a good idea. I'm not sure it's a good use of funds, because just think about the word radical. I mean, radical is a subjective word. It's not an objective word. I mean, I've got, who doesn't have a radical uncle or something like that? I mean, it could mean so many different things. So if we want to do counter-radicalization, it seems, I don't know, it just seems too squishy for me to really get my head around as a scientist, as an economist. But things that do make sense are the things we've been talking about, which is, how do I think about the drug gang on the streets of Baltimore? As a business, I can make perfect sense of that. I often ask my students to their great frustration, if we need to care about motivation. If I see somebody running a drug gang in Baltimore, or running a drug cartel in Colombia, or running a terrorist organization in the United States or anywhere in the world, and I look at the leader, I look at that entrepreneur, do I need to know why they're doing it? It might help to know why, but I don't know that I need to know why. And I think that's a good question for us to explore. When we try to understand why, we're getting into things like surveys and survey results and things like that, and people are misleading intentionally often. If I know, however, that they need to generate revenues and minimize costs, and as long as revenues exceed costs and they can make payroll and they can deter defection, that they're going to stay in business, I don't need to know why they're selling drugs or they're blowing up airplanes. I know how I can help them to fail as a business. And it seems to me that's what I need to know. If I want to put a drug dealer out of business, I don't need to know what's in his heart or hers. I need to know how to get them to fail as a business.
But the way we've done that historically in the United States, we've used economics. We've tried, it's a really primitive form of it, and I think yours is a richer approach, but I'm going to let you have at it. We've tried to raise the cost. We say, look, you sell drugs on the street, you could go to jail. You could get killed. We've tried to make it more expensive and less attractive, and I would say that has utterly failed, right? So, what's an alternative approach? Another approach would be to create more jobs in the neighborhood to make it harder for those folks to attract lieutenants and privates and people in their army right? You could try that approach. What else you got? And by the way, the flip side of that in the terrorist story is, in places with bad governance, you want more governance if you can find a way to get it there, which is hard to do because they're an alternative to that. And then ideally you want more trade to raise the cost to me of destructive non-trade, non-cooperative activity. Does economics have anything more to say than that?
So just I'm gonna answer that with the three points that I make in the book. But before I do, in The Wire, there's this wonderful character named Stringer Bell. Stringer Bell is played by a young Idris Elba, who has gone on to become one of the most famous, and wonderful actors in the world. But Idris Elba is Stringer Bell, who actually, he's the deputy for the particular drug gang, the Barksdale gang in Baltimore, in this fictional account. And he goes to the local community college, and he takes classes in economics to help him run his drug organization better, which is just a beautiful kind of cap on this idea that it's a business. They're running a business, and Stringer Bell is asking questions about, you know, elasticity of demand of the professor.
Right? I remember that scene. I think it's slightly fictional in the sense that I don't think taking economics helps you really that much become a better drug dealer, but I got the idea. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, he's trying to figure out how to price his product in a competitive market, which is what entrepreneurs do.
Yeah.
So I suggest that my idea here is let's understand a better way to look at phenomena in the world. Let's understand crime, insurgency, and terrorism better, and not label it as crime, insurgency, and terrorism, but let's blur the line as you described that we do with Pablo Escobar. But what can we really do about it? So I have three ideas. First is, let's analyze like business executives. So if I'm looking at Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State or the Sinaloa cartel, I'm going to treat them all the same, first of all. I'm going to look at them, and I want to know, if I were a venture capitalist that was thinking about investing in them, would they be a good investment? Would that firm be worthy of my investment dollars, right? It's strange to think about the Islamic State and the Sinaloa cartel is selling shares and raising money. But I think we should think about it as investors. And do we believe in the business model? So tell me about the leadership structure. Do I think the CEO and the CFO are good, you know, solid people? Do they have a strong mission? Do they have... Do they have product market fit? Are they selling a product that has elasticity of demand or not? What are their competitors like? Is it a deep market? Do they have massive market share or only a portion of the market share? What's their balance sheet look like? Do they have lots of money in the bank to get them through hard times, or are they just getting by, you know, month to month? How do they recruit? How do they retain? What's their defection constraint? What's their turnover rate? How often, what percentage of their employee base turns over every year? These are really standard business questions that any investor would ask of any potential investment. We should be asking these questions of these firms that we're trying to defeat. These are good, solid questions. Second is we want to define victory in market terms. So when, you know, over the last 15 years, we've been fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've been very close in some years, more close in some years than others to this. And I think we got victory wrong. Victory is not, you know, signing a peace treaty and walking away. I don't know that victory ever was that, but it's definitely not that now. Killing the leader, right? Doesn't really bring about victory in market terms. You know, if you're Coke versus Pepsi or you know, IBM versus, you know, Cisco or whatever, you know, you don't think about taking out the leadership. You'd think about taking market share. So once we've done the analysis of these firms, we have to think about us as a rival firm to them, or our allies as rival firms to them, and we want to take market share from them. Taking market share could mean kill the leader, but it doesn't always mean kill the leader, right? Sometimes that is productive. Sometimes that's not productive in the context of violence and warfare. We have to think about how do we win in the marketplace in which this firm operates, in which the Sinaloa cartel and the Islamic State operate? How do we defeat them as a rival firm? So we have to define victory properly. And then the third thing is, we have to fight like an entrepreneur. So we have to think about the ways in which we would go to market. When we think about going to market in drug dealing, we think about the DEA. When we think about counterterrorism, we think about the DOD. It seems to me that that's a overly narrow and focused view of how we're supposed to be a market participant. So we, the United States, or our friends and allies around the world, should think of ourselves as firms in markets, and let's go to war as a firm would in this context. So how do we diminish the ability to recruit? How do we encourage defections? How do we deplete resources that they might have in banks? I think we do a lot of these things piecemeal and case by case, but I think we should think more holistically as a firm competing against a firm in a competitive marketplace. And that's really fundamentally, Russ, what I'm arguing is if we think about terrorism as a function of Islam and drug dealing as a function of, you know, Mexican right. and Colombian, yeah, right, whatever, I think we're missing out on the fact that markets, firms, entrepreneurs are really the key ideas for making a difference in the world.
Let's talk for a second about taking out leadership. Sometimes in the case of say a mafia war, the person who does the killing wants the other side to know who did it. There's a tribal kinship thing for their own side. They avenge something sometimes, but sometimes you don't want the people to know who did it. And no one takes credit for some of these deaths. And they, you know, one of the things your book taught me is that the virtue of that is it widens the range of possible enemies you might have that you're not aware of, right. which spreads you thin. That's a way that you make a firm less effective. The part I think that is effective that I wonder if you underplay, though, is the talent is scarce. And if you take out a leader, it's true that that leader will be replaced, but presumably that leader will not be as talented. And there's also the competition for that role is diminished when you know that you can be killed. So it's a way of turning the violence against that group that they've been imposing on other people. Do you think that's a legitimate way to think about it?
I think that's a simplistic way to think about it. I think that's true sometimes, but I think it's worthwhile to take a step back and ask if that's the case all of the time. Two examples. First, Steve Levitt in Levitt and Venkatesh, they did a paper on the drug wars in Chicago, where they actually got the books and the payroll, and they asked this question about, you know, if gang wars are bad for revenue. Right, decrease revenue, increase costs. Why do we see violence across gangs? And one of their conclusions of their, I think, very interesting paper is that it's a competition. It's a lottery. It's like if you're street level, you could make more money working at Home Depot than street level in a drug gang. But if you go get the minimum wage job, you'll never make a lot of money. But if you enter the drug gang, right. And if enough people above you get killed, and if you survive, you might actually make a lot of money one day, right? So it's a tournament. It's a tournament is that idea. Second example is we worked for years, the United States worked for years to help the Colombians get rid of Pablo Escobar. And what happened the day we got rid of Pablo Escobar is the Cali cartel stepped in. We didn't change the market, Russ. We just right. killed an entrepreneur.
Right.
And the Cali cartel was probably very supportive of our efforts to defeat head of the Medellin cartel because they just took over the market. So I think anecdotally, you could come up with cases in which getting rid of the leader made a difference, and you could come up with instances in which getting rid of the leader doesn't make a difference, which is why I argue you have to think like a business person, fight like an entrepreneur, and you have to ask yourself, that rival firm, that CEO is super valuable, and if we get rid of him, it's likely to harm the operations of the firm, or that CEO is surrounded by a talented bench, and that CEO is really not material to our ability to defeat the firm. And I think we have to ask those kinds of questions.
My guest today has been Gary Shiffman. His book is The Economics of Violence. Gary, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Russ, loved it. Thanks very much.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.